This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's a Europod. We've got a lot to catch up on. Is it Nicky Bandini's dream top two in Serie A? Napoli lead the way after a 2-1 win over Champions Milan, while Atalanta are level on points, beating Roma, for whom there's a red card for Jose Mourinho. Don't say you didn't want to hear that. Are Juve the most in-crisis team in Europe? Or is that Bayern Munich only won 3 of their 7? They couldn't not win the title, could they? Depressing racist abuse from Atleti fans against Vinicius Jr. overshadows the Madrid derby, but he dances his way to Real's 6th straight win. Why are there so many red cards in France? Is Messi better than ever? Brackets no, but he's still really good. Will players start owning their own stats? And a big apology to Carlos Puyol. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini mentioned in the intro, it would be impolite not to have you on the pod after that.
Yeah, it's been a weekend all around, hasn't it? I mean, I think it was one of the most crazy weekends in Serie A for ages. And then on top of that, an Italian got appointed by a Premier League club just in the last very small amount of time. And I don't even know when that happened, Max. I've lost sense of time completely, but I know everyone wants to hear about De Zerbi as well.
Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va bien, et toi?
Ça va bien. Mark Langdon, hello.
Hello, Max.
From the Racing Post, of course. Let's start with Serie A then. As I said in the intro, Nick, is this your dream? Napoli 1, Atalanta 2? Or do you want it the other way around? Or am I just making up who I think you like the most in that league?
I think you might be making that up in a greater sense. I don't, I get asked often who my Italian team is. This happens a lot. And as everyone who listens to Football Weekly knows, or at least has been listening for a while, I'm an Arsenal fan. I did grow up in London, so Arsenal's my team. My Italian family are mostly for Inter, but yeah, one team's enough for me. So I just like stories that are interesting and different. And Atalanta have been a great story the last few seasons. And Napoli this season are also a brilliant story. And above anything else, they play really fun, entertaining football. But I think because I like the stories, what's interesting to me is how they got there, Max. And Napoli, of course, got there, I suppose, in the more high-profile way because they beat Milan on Sunday night.
Yeah, the hero, son of Diego, Giovanni Simeone, actually does really well for that goal, doesn't he? Because he's patient, he holds it up, and then he gets into the box to score a brilliant header.
Yeah, I think Giovanni Simeone is like such a fascinating sort of case study within this team, and that actually sort of speaks a lot to why this Napoli team are so good, why they are sort of surprising people a bit this season. Because actually this was kind of a top of the table clash, two teams that are absolutely, I would say, ahead of Atalanta. It's still Milan and Napoli are my two favourites at this point for the Scudetto. And both of them are missing one of their most important players because Milan are missing Rafael Leao and Napoli are missing Victor Osimhen. So they're both missing a forward who is really integral to how they play. And Simeone doesn't even start for Napoli. He comes off the bench and ends up scoring the winning goal with his lovely header. And I think it's interesting just in and of itself that he's not short. I think he's about 5'10", but he's certainly not the tallest guy, Simeone. And he scores these headers. He's good at getting into those areas in the box. As you say, it's a real sort of tribute to his movement and how he uses himself in the box. But that there's a bigger picture here for me, which is that Milan, despite probably still getting the better of the play in this game, they did hit the woodwork twice, so it's a game that could easily have gone a different way. I still came away from this thinking, okay, so Leao's out, and that attack looks more reliant than ever on Olivier Giroud, who's been brilliant, right? Who scored in this game, who is continuing to be a really essential player. But Napoli, who not so long ago would have been thought of as not able to compete with teams like Milan financially, I mean, they still aren't in terms of their overall budget, look like the team with the deeper squad. Because Napoli can turn to the bench and say, well, not only is Osimhen missing, but we started Raspadori at centre forward, then we took off Raspadori and sent on Simeone, and Simeone got the winning goal. And that depth about this Napoli team is something that's really different and I think surprising to a lot of us, myself included, who thought they were going to have a difficult season after saying goodbye to Insigne and Mertens and Koulibaly.
And I'd wonder, Mark, do you think because we saw them hammer Liverpool, and I suppose that would have really piqued what gets piqued? Your interest. Your eyes don't get piqued, do they?
That's usually your interest.
Really sounds quite painful to have your eyes piqued. But a lot of things got piqued when they did that. I mean, I don't know if they have the depth to go far in that competition as well.
Well, I mean, it's a really tight group. They've made a great start, Napoli, but there are, tougher games, I think, for them to come. They'll have to go to Anfield. They've got this double header coming up against Ajax, who, showed up pretty well at Liverpool, albeit that I think that the right team won in the end. I think they probably have got fewer bigger names, but maybe more depth to the squad this time around. They obviously shared, as Nicky was saying, some real talented players in the summer. I suppose my doubt about them is that last season they were the best team in the early part of the campaign and were unable to hold on. And so I suppose you just wonder whether the same will happen again. But as Nicky was saying, I think to be able to have Simeone as potentially third choice striker, Raspadori can play up there as well, I think does give them more depth. I'd still like to see it. Non-believers, I suppose, and until they actually get over the line, even when they had that great forward line, Lavezzi and Cavani, they got so close and were unable to get over the line. The Sarri team, when Koulibaly scored really late on at Juventus, it looked like that was going to be the time for Napoli, and then the next week it all went wrong for them. So I'm one of those, I want to see them do it before I actually believe it, but I think it is a great story. I love watching them play. And, I haven't got a favourite team in Italy either, but I would like to see them win the league, I think.
What about Atalanta? They beat Roma in a game that, a bit like the Milan game, could have gone either way. In fact, Roma had buckets of really good chances today, including Tammy Abraham just sort of shunting one wide very slowly for no apparent reason. But look, they still got the win and they're still, they're in a great position at the moment.
Yeah, Atalanta joint top with Napoli, as you say. It was strange because, as you've sort of just alluded to, I thought this was, weirdly, I think this might have been Roma's best performance the whole season. I thought Roma were really good in a way that they haven't always been in some of their wins this season, but they just couldn't get the goal. And of course, they had Paulo Dybala leave the game injured in the warm-ups as well. And you think, well, if you can't score a goal and you're missing that one guy, then of course that's... that's going to be an influence as well. But I think it was interesting because we're almost seeing a different wave of Atalanta. We associate Atalanta as being the attacking team, the one that will sort of get up on you, that will be in your face and that will play man-to-man across the pitch. And they are still playing man-to-man across the pitch. But actually, this Atalanta team this season so far, it's still only seven games, conceded only 3 goals. They've got the joint best defence of all in all of Serie A. I think it's interesting that the teenager who came on to score their winning goal in this game, Giorgio Scalvini, who is a very interesting prospect, certainly looks the part, sort of tall, lean, but still quite agile despite being quite muscular. Well, I've seen him as a midfielder because that's where he's playing. He's been a defender through most of his youth career. And Gasperini said at the end of the game, I don't know what this guy's final position is, but it almost sort of felt like a physical representation of this slight emphasis shift at Atalanta, that they're no longer going to be a gung-ho team. Maybe they're going to be a more defensive team that brings a defender up from the youth team and puts them into midfield. But regardless, it was defender, midfielder, whatever you want to call him. I thought it was a really lovely finish from Scalvini. Yeah. And another teenager to be excited about.
Jose got sent off. That sounds great to me. Is this the moment when the wheels fall off? I mean, actually, Roma looked like they played quite well in this game.
Yeah, like I said, Max, I don't know what to say about Roma because I think they've played some games much worse than this season. I thought this was one of their better games. There have been some times when they've been winning and I've been going, they didn't really do a lot. But this one was the opposite. I think they do have... Strangely, despite having quite an abundance of attacking options, because you've got Dybala, you've got Zaniolo, you've got Pellegrini, and you've got Tammy Abraham, they do have this slightly odd sense of a lack of ruthlessness about them. They've got a lot of players there who you think are pretty sort of good at creating opportunity, but aren't necessarily the most punishing. And that's where Tammy Abraham's supposed to be the guy. Tammy Abraham's got to be the one who is punishing, who does always take those chances for them. And he's had it's not a terrible start. He scored twice in 7 games, but I think compared to last season when he was really sort of hitting that goal, best in every other game mark, he's had a slightly indifferent start. And I think they're waiting for him to wake up a bit. And if he does, then I think they'll be just fine. I don't think the wheel's coming off or anything.
What was the Jose red card?
Oh, this was ridiculous. Nicola Zaniolo was trying to win a penalty, and he literally grabs the shirt of the defender and pulls him down his way into the area. And then minutes later as well, because that wasn't enough sort of being an idiot, does an even more blatant dive, and then gets very, very put out that the referee isn't giving in to his dives. And of course, Jose being Jose takes the side of his players, gets involved in it, protests too much and gets sent off. I mean, it's not a new story. And but yeah, that Zaniolo was being ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous.
Just one thing, going back to Gasperini, Nikki, mm-hmm. he's been in place for 6 years now. Mm-hmm. He has a contract which leads him to, I think, 2024 with an extra year option. Is that something completely unusual? I mean, this is like an awful long time. Usually Serie A, we're used at seeing, you know, managers going pop, 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 pop from one club to the next. That's completely, is it unique actually in today's landscape?
I mean, there's a few long contracts kicking about. I don't know if we're going to talk about Juventus and the fact they can't really sack Max Allegri because he's under contract till 2025. But Gasperini and Atalanta have got a very unique relationship. I think both parties sort of appreciate quite strongly what the other represents for each other. You know, Gasperini has taken Atalanta to heights they never would have imagined. They finished third in three consecutive seasons. They made it to the Champions League knockout rounds. And I think to a certain degree, when you've done that, you earn yourself a certain untouchable status. And the fact as well that he's done that while there's been quite a heavy rotation of players. Again, look at this group this season. And you think it's not just that we've said goodbye to Ilicic and Papu Gomez, sort of the big beasts of the last couple of seasons. But even players like Pessina, who's wound up at Monza of all places. And you think, well, they've given up a lot of players you would have thought a year ago were in their starting 11. Robin Gosens, who's off at Inter. And they keep reinventing themselves. So I think from the club's point of view, sure, he's more expensive than he used to be, but he's not an expensive option to be someone who can allow them to run this business model of constant turnover effectively. And from Gasperini's point of view, he's done the big club. He went to Inter. He got fired after about 5 minutes because he had a horrible start. And I think he's very happy to be somewhere that he just feels very supported. I wonder if this season has started differently, if the story might have gone differently, because of course they did slip last year. They were down to, I think it was eighth in the end last season. But it seems like, no, they've just come together and reinvented again. And so I think it's just one of those very nice symbiotic relationships, really.
You mentioned Monza, first ever win for the Formula One circuit against Juventus. Autumn says, how bad are things at Juve? Is there an Italian phrase that translates to crisis club? Andy, on the off chance that the hierarchy at Juve were checking in on people on Sunday night, who do they phone first? Zidane, Pochettino or Tuchel? But as you're saying, right, they can't sack Allegri. Is that the problem? They are stuck.
Yeah, I want to emphasise just quickly what this Monza result was, because Monza, promoted to Serie A for the first time in their history this season, had played 6 games in total in Serie A, in which they'd conceded 14 goals, had a minus 11 goal difference. They'd got one draw from those 6 games. They'd lost all the rest of them. And their manager, Raffaele Palladino, who they hired for this game, or they promoted rather, because he was in charge of their youth team, had never taken charge of a senior football game before. He'd been their under-15 coach for a year and then their under-19 coach for a year. That's it. Amazing. And this team then beats Juventus. So like their first win ever in Serie A, that's the context of it. Astonishing, astonishing result. And yes, certainly felt like a new low for Juve. You think they've just got beaten in the Champions League by Benfica. They've actually were unbeaten in Serie A before this, but 4 of their 6 games before this were draws. Remember that Max Allegri, the manager, was saying in pre-season, we have a duty to win the league. Like, not we sort of, oh, we're going to try and do better than last season. Like, we have a duty to be the number one team in Italy. And yeah, they were awful. They were really, really awful. They didn't deserve any more than they got. They were on 10 men from the 40th minute because Di Maria got sent off. But even before that, they weren't good. And it's... there's sort of two competing voices in my head, right? One of which is, you can go back to 2015-16 and Juventus actually started even worse than this. They had fewer points. They went on to win the league, convincingly as well, with 91 points. And then you have the evidence of what your eyes are telling you, which is this team has been dreadful and lifeless and can't even come up with a response against Monza, who've been really bad. I mean, Roma thumped Monza 4-0. I don't think Allegri's getting sacked now. I feel confident he's not getting sacked now. Since Agnelli took over as president, they've never changed a manager mid-season. Now, admittedly, that's like a 12-year stretch in which they won the league 9 times. So perhaps that's a slightly sort of misleading thing to focus on. But they didn't get rid of Pirlo when things were going very, very badly. They saw it through to the end. And I think there was a sense of, well, as long as we still make the top four, as long as we still get that Champions League money, it's better to not do this. And I think that you had this sort of really joking exchange from the CEO, Arif Akbernet, with a fan in midweek that was very revealing, even though it was a joke, which was he'd come out of a meeting with some Benfica executives. He was taking some photos and signing autographs with fans. And one of them sort of said to him, basically, Allegri out. And he said, oh, and you're going to pay for the next one, are you? As a joke. But also, he's getting paid, you know, I can't remember if it's 7 million or 9 million euros a year. Either way, he's there, because in Italy they always mix it up with talking about pre-tax and post-tax. But he's the joint best paid manager in Serie A, along with Mourinho. And he's under contract till 2025. And you signed him specifically because you thought, this is the guy who understands the Juventus ethos, who understands that we don't need to be pretty always, as long as we just win. And now you've gone out and you've got him, Di Maria. You've got him, Paul Pogba, who admittedly isn't there. You've got him, Vlahovic, last January. And yes, if you want to qualify it, Pogba isn't there, Di Maria's getting himself sent off, and Chiesa isn't there either, who's a big player for them. But still, you provided all these pieces and you're not getting results. It feels really, really ugly, but it also does feel like a situation from which Juventus can't easily extricate themselves. I'm sorry, that's a really long answer. I haven't said the bit which you did ask about, which if there's another manager. Tuchel is the name that's been mentioned the most in Turin. Tuchel is the name they seem to be talking about, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think Juventus won't. I think at the soonest, if Juventus think it's really bad, they might do something at the time when the World Cup happens. I think nothing will happen before that. But even then, I think recent history tells us it would have to be very bad, recent history and cost, before Juventus actually decided to make a change.
Yeah, I think with Max Allegri, I remember reading an article interview, I think it was made probably Rory Smith, it was in New York Times, and this was during his sabbatical, Allegri, and honestly, it really alarmed me, the interview, and it wasn't a hard-hitting piece, it just allowed Allegri to talk about his philosophy, or rather lack of philosophy, because he said he doesn't believe in philosophies and, you know, it's only about winning. And he was kind of dismissive of, I suppose, modern approaches in terms of data and analytics and that philosophy and a way of playing. He admitted to not even owning a computer and said, apart from his family iPad, you know, that's about it. He spoke about a horse racing trainer, a legend in Italy called Federico Tessio, who basically did everything. He was a breeder, he was a trainer, but, you know, he died in 1954 and was successful in the 1930s. And it was all about, for him, it was about the eye and sort of, you know, you could get a sense of, you know, whether a horse was going to be good by looking at them. And he said it was the same with footballers. And he, you know, he spent so much time with the racetrack with his granddad, and, you know, that was the way to be. And I just think, like, there's nobody really in modern football that thinks and believes like that. And of course he did well in his first spell. I just feel like if you're looking to, you know, modernise the club and maybe sort of, you know, there would be some hard times, I think, for Juventus because of the players that they lost and the way that they're trying to maybe reinvent themselves with some of the players that Nicky was talking about there, particularly Vlahovic and Chiesa. It just feels like maybe a more forward-thinking coach would be better suited to trying to sort of take them on this different path.
Matt says, please can Nikki give a summary of Roberto Di Zerbi and her opinion on his move to Brighton? We can all Google him, but would appreciate her thoughts as someone who has watched his time at Sassuolo, etc. Thanks. We did mainly focus on his goatee beard yesterday, so some actual football might be quite useful.
Yeah, Di Zerbi, I think he'll be a lot of fun. He had a pretty successful stint at Sassuolo. He was there for 3 seasons, finished, I think, 11th, 8th, 8th. And yeah, they're a team who only got into Serie A for the first time beginning of last decade. 8th isn't quite the highest position, they have been 6th, but it's a solid position for them. Being in the upper half of the table is a good result for Sassuolo. And he got it by doing very sort of, well, I would go sort of right on the borderline of expansive and just outright reckless football, because they all one-touch passing out from the back moved them to this 4-2-3-1 with a double pivot in midfield, where it was just like, literally, we're not going to hump the ball long over. We're going to always play out from the back. We're always going to do these one-touch passes. And quite often it's going to turn out we're not as good as we think we are and we're going to get ourselves in trouble. But also, we're going to be more overall more successful than not. I mean, they, again, were finishing in the top half of the table. He did bring through some sort of players like Berardi and really elevate their talents and develop them into even more sort of effective forwards and attackers in particular. He has this great knack with even sort of Chicho Caputo, who wasn't a young player he brought through, was someone at the latter end of his career, but he turned him into this absolutely prolific number nine. Even sort of Pep Guardiola gave him some sort of positive words about how they played football. But look, really, really fun, really fast, really zippy, passing out from the back again. I think that, again, that double pivot midfield is a real hallmark of De Zerbi football. And to give you some context, the sort of team that I think Sassuolo finished a couple of seasons in a row scoring more than 60 goals, but also conceding more than 60 goals. So it's that sort of football.
He's Ozzy Ardiles. This is marvellous. All right, that'll do for Italy. We'll do Germany and Spain next. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
It starts the same way.
Can I tell you a secret?
It would start off with a random girl and just say, hey, hun, I'm going to tell you some secret now. Please don't mention it to anybody.
But it quickly escalates.
It just spread like a wildfire.
I still sleep with clubs next to my bed.
I didn't know how far this was going to go.
People seldom show their true selves online, but one man, he's taken it much further.
I was terrified.
Who is the cyberstalker behind these messages?
He actually said to me, good luck proving it's me.
And why is he sending them?
Because he became more and more isolated. He just went within himself even further.
Do you punish someone for acting out whatever is going on in their mind that we don't understand?
And if I could just turn back the clock.
From The Guardian, I'm Shireen Khaleh, and this is Can I Tell You a Secret? A story about obsession, fear, and the lives we lead online. Search for Can I Tell You a Secret wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now. All episodes will be available on Friday, the 23rd of September.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. To the Bundesliga then. James says, are Bayern finished? Is Nagelsmann's job at risk? It'd be good for the Bundesliga to have a new winner for the first time in, what, a decade? Sean says, is Mane making Liverpool and Bayern terrible at the same time? Mark, dare we dream that Bayern Munich won't win the league this season?
Well, we may as well dream because it's more likely than it has been in recent years. I mean, look, this was not a good performance from them. They created enough chances at Augsburg, lost 1-0. I think it says much for Mane's performance that the closest Bayern came to scoring was through Manuel Neuer when he went up for a corner in the
ninth. It was a good header, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And I mean, Neuer is, I mean, he's fantastic with his feet and obviously with his head as well. They had 77% possession, 19 shots. Whenever Bayern are going to sort of lose, not win, there will be question marks as to whether Lewandowski would have changed the result. I mean, that's just natural. You know, I don't think they had that much choice with Lewandowski. He made it pretty clear that he wanted to leave for Barcelona, and he was going. And I think financially it made sense, you know, his age to sell. And Julian Nagelsmann wanted a more fluid front line, and that he felt that Mane was much more the type of forward that could sort of help bring his football, onto the pitch, and that he didn't want somebody to be in the box all the time. And so I think that's fine as long as Mane scores, and he did at the start, and it was working well. But this was the first time now in 87 matches that Bayern had failed to score in the Bundesliga.
What?
Mane is 5 without
that
goal.
Is mad. That's 87 games.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean,
that's ridiculous. You know,
they usually win. So I mean,
that is true.
And it's their worst start in 20 years. So there are, I suppose, I think, outside pressure probably more than internal pressure on Julian Nagelsmann. I think there are question marks from some supporters as to whether he's the right person inside the club. Bayern have been very clear that there's no panic. There's a lot of time to sort out this situation. But last season wasn't a great one for Bayern. They won the league, but in terms of the Champions League, they went out to Villarreal, which is... it's unacceptable is maybe a bit strong because you can lose knockout matches, but it's not what Bayern expects. And even this season against Barcelona last week, I mean, if Lewandowski takes his chances like he normally does, I think that you get a completely different result from that match as well. Thomas Tuchel, who Nicky said has been linked with Juventus, is also being linked with the Bayern job. There were definitely people that wanted Tuchel before he went to Paris 2018, maybe 2018-2019 time. So I think that when you've got a manager like Tuchel on the sidelines just waiting to be brought back in, that will increase the pressure on a lot of managers in Europe's top leagues where maybe the big clubs are failing. But the message from inside Bayern is that they're not panicking just yet and they expect to get better. And this is just a minor blip en route to winning the Bundesliga, and the they're saying we'll just be better after the international break. But they need to get better.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, they do.
Union Berlin are top. I mean, obviously, I know everything about them, but for listeners who perhaps only know that they're in Berlin, what can you tell us about them?
Well, I mean, this is a remarkable story. This is there aren't many feel-good factor sort of stories in football anymore. You know, they just get a bit depressed with kind of, and we'll probably get on to some of the more depressing ones in a while. But Union,
well, Philippe is here. You know, that's what
you're
bring us the hard truths.
Union Berlin are very much a club that sort of bases itself around their supporters. When they came up to the Bundesliga, they were seen as this team that were not going to kind of, not really about modern football. It's about the supporters. It's about the kind of hard work from the community and those that kind of got them up into the Bundesliga. And they've stayed sort of as true as they can, I think, to that sort of ethos, really, and of them all together. And they've managed to get themselves into Europe, which I think maybe... could be a stretch for them, but the way that it's going at the moment, a 2-0 win against Wolfsburg at the weekend. The front two have been scoring a lot of goals. So Jordan Pefok is somebody that part of that goal scoring, but also a guy that I didn't really know that much about, Becker, not Boris Becker, but Becker up front, top scorer in the Bundesliga. They just find, I suppose, unheralded players. Not much really of a backstory to them, and that they're just a really sort of heartwarming story. You look around at sort of some of the more fashionable teams, I suppose, in terms of the Bundesliga. Leipzig are not doing great at the moment. Wolfsburg themselves, are not really struggling. Bayer Leverkusen haven't started the season well, so maybe there is an opportunity there. And this also comes back to Archie speaks about all the time when he's on the 50+1. And I think that the ownership rules, and I think there is a lot of goodwill from sort of just neutral sort of Bundesliga fans, I suppose. Just you'd rather somebody like Union Berlin were sort of up there rather than Wolfsburg, rather than Bayer Leverkusen, rather than Leipzig. So let's just see if it can carry on. I hope so.
Philippe just put his hand up, which I presume he's just about to say they're owned by an arms dealer or something. 51% arms dealer.
No, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. I think I'm right, but they still have the old scoreboard as well, Mark.
Oh, I haven't been. I've never been to the ground, Philippe, so I don't know.
Okay, the old scoreboard. If I'm correct, it's quite extraordinary. It's like imagine you're at a fifth or sixth division ground. And it's not LED.
Yes, it's an old cricket scoreboard.
Yes, absolutely. And they don't have the name of the club which is visiting them. They have FC Union, and then they've got Gast, the guest.
Yeah.
That's it. There's nothing else. And they're sponsored by a brand of sausages. I mean, the scoreboard is a brand of sausages. It's magnificent. Yes. It's magnificent.
Richtig good, diverse. Right, good, the sausage. And they have basically, there's two big windows, and if either team scores, someone just sticks a head out the window and just puts a big three or a big two or whatever.
That's the way it should be done.
That is really good. Let's go to La Liga. Biggest story in Spain was Atletico Madrid monkey chance aimed at Vinicius Jr. Incredibly depressing. A La Liga spokesperson said, "We denounce all incidents inside and outside stadiums. Hate speech has no place in La Liga." His celebration after scoring, he does this dance, has drawn comments from pundits. An agent called Pedro Bravo was on El Chiringuito the other day saying, "In Spain, you have to respect rivals and, quote, stop playing the monkey." He has since apologized. Vinicius Jr. came out with a statement saying, "Look, weeks ago, some people started to criticize my dancing, but the dancing is not mine alone. It belongs to Ronaldinho, Neymar, Lucas Paqueta, Antoine Griezmann, João Felix, black funk singers, samba dancers, Latin reggaeton singers, black Americans. They're dancers to celebrate the cultural diversity of the world. They say that happiness bothers. The happiness of a black Brazilian being successful in Europe bothers much more, but my will to win, my smile and the sparkle in my eyes are much bigger than that." He's actually a really interesting guy, Philippe, isn't he? I mean, the story is really depressing, but he has been incredibly mature, so he's suffering something he should never have to suffer.
Well, yes. Well, to be honest, I don't know exactly what to add to his comments, because I think this was a perfect response. There's nothing else to say apart from the fact that no apologies, no messages of apologies and no regrets will be enough, and that I'm afraid that Spain still has this problem, and it's not going to change until they do something about it, and they're not going to do anything about it. So it's not. I'm not very optimistic about that. I'm more optimistic for Vinicius' career than I am about the problem with racism with some fans of some clubs in Spain. What can I say? What more can I say?
Nicky?
I just wanted to ask Philippe about Tchouaméni, who seems to be like, have stepped in there and just immediately sort of made that midfield his own so impressively. And you think they sort of said goodbye to Casemiro in the summer, and you think that's not an easy replacement. And it just seems like he's doing brilliantly.
Yeah, he is. But I think that's absolutely no surprise to anyone who was following before that. And what the surprise was that they were able to get him so easily, because I would have thought that there were a few other clubs. Arsenal were after him for a while and were priced out. But there's absolutely no surprise. And in fact, you can see that I think France's midfield in 2026 is probably playing for Real Madrid right now, isn't it? Because the other one is not so bad either. Mr. Camavinga.
I think as well, that pass for the first goal is
amazing.
It's probably not something that Casemiro has got in his locker. So obviously a lot of strengths to Casemiro and the way that he's able to move the team around. But I just felt the pass, the vision for it was a great finish as well from Rodrigo. And they did celebrate with the dance, which pleased me. Also, within that goal, and he scored the second goal, but Fede Valverde probably been one of the players of the season, I would say, so far. He scored a magnificent goal a couple of weeks ago and has really been driving this Real Madrid team forward, from a sort of nominal position out on the right. He's not a winger, and I think he ideally would like to play more centrally, but a lot of competition for spots in that central area for Real Madrid. So he's doing a really great job for them. I mean, Real Madrid played the good guys in the Champions League at times last season when they knocked out a couple of teams. And it felt like they were the good guys again in this match. And it made me laugh after the game when Diego Simeone was bemoaning Real Madrid's low block.
That is sensational.
And the defensive tactics of Real. So there was maybe, that was very ironic. But just getting back very quickly to Simeone and the racism, I felt like he could have done so much more. I mean, he's somebody, you know, he's supposed to be a really strong leader, and he's, you know, he's always grabbing his balls and telling us how big his balls are. And I think that he could have been so much you know, more authoritative. In he was asked the day before the game about Vinicius and the racism he suffered, and he said, "We live in a society in which we are all involved. We are people, and this is the society we have." So he basically said absolutely nothing, where he could have said, you know, something along the lines of, "Really hope Vinicius doesn't score, you know, but, you know, if you are racist towards him, you're not Atletico, you're not part of this club." But he didn't do that. Koke was also asked about what would happen if Vinicius scored and danced, and he said there would be trouble, which is almost instigating the trouble before it started. So I think Atletico as a club needed to do much more, I think, to stop the actions of their supporters. And like I say, I'm quite pleased that Real Madrid won the game.
Yeah, well said. CMR says, how does Griezmann playing 90 minutes affect Sid's spreadsheet? Yeah, he started and he played the whole game. I thought he'd be hooked after 29 minutes. What does this mean, Mark?
Well, it means, I think, that Atletico and Barca are moving towards a resolution, exactly. Which I think is best for everybody. You know, Barcelona can maybe get some money. Atletico can use Griezmann in a more normal way, and for the player himself, it's not great for him to be used in this way. Philippe, I don't know if he's spoken himself about the situation.
Not really, but the thing that it should happen just after, I think, is FIFA started saying that they were going to look into the matter, and FIFPro is looking into the matter with these ridiculous clauses in contracts, which mean that some players are only playing like 30 minutes of a game, because if they play more than that, it triggers a clause. That's ridiculous. And that's quite obviously what's been happening in this case, isn't it? I mean, Mark, I mean, it's the only reason is financial and contractual.
I wonder if there are some players who'd just quite like to just play 28 minutes. Every week. This is good. Just come on, have an impact. You won't be that tired. You have a lovely life.
I mean, it's one thing in the big picture, but I think very genuinely leading up to a World Cup, that might be an ideal situation for some players to make sure you're going to sort of keep your arm in, as it were, to keep yourself playing, but also know that you're not going to grind yourself down too much leading into this sort of...
You mean like Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw, for example?
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? But it's like, you know, it's just texting the gaffer saying, I've probably only got a half hour in me. I'm running a marathon tomorrow, sort of Sunday league. What can I just play? I just played 20. Barcelona, good form continued. Elche at bottom, had a man sent off after 13 minutes. That made it more difficult. Lewandowski's got a couple. And Depay actually scored a brilliant goal, I thought, Mark. The strength in that turn were brilliant.
It was. I thought it was going to be ruined by an offside. It was really tight.
It was tight,
It was a really tight VAR call, but thankfully, about a toenail onside. But it was good to see Memphis playing. I'm a bit conflicted because I don't like the way Barcelona have kind of risked their future in this way. But I was watching the game against Elche, and the Nou Camp was nearly full. And it felt good to have Barcelona back. And I do worry about what sort of will happen in 5 years' time. But I looked at that team from where they were 12 months ago. And
it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, and they're so much stronger. And it sounds obvious, you know, you've got Lewandowski up front. But even somebody like Balde, left back, young 18-year-old, was involved in a couple of the goals. I like the way that Xavi's got the team playing. There is a feel-good factor to Barcelona, and it feels like, I suppose, football is better with a stronger Barcelona, but I don't like the way that they've risked the future of the club in doing it, but I can understand why there is excitement back at the club, at least.
I think it's, Mark, you're here, Mark, for feel-good vibes, so just okay. Go with it. Just, you know, it's good to have a good Barcelona, so happy days. All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with France. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Liam says, what's going on in France? Which I agree, Philippe, is quite a vague question. But he did send a picture of the number of red cards in France.
Yes, it's
this
amazing.
Season. In Ligue 2, 45. In Ligue 1, 34. In La Liga, by comparison, 20. Serie A, 15. Bundesliga, 12. The Premier League's only been 4. What's happening there? But what's that? Are the French just filthy, Philippe?
I think there were instructions given to referees before the start of the season, which were the exact opposite of the instructions which were given to Premier League referees.
Brilliant, so, brilliant.
So, you know, it's kind of European homogeneity, so that we all know what to expect when we have the next Euros or whatever. That's the only explanation that is possible, because some of the decisions which have been taken are frankly quite ridiculous. And despite or because of the use of VAR as well, you would have thought this would actually balance things, but not at all. There was one week, the third week of French football, there were actually 11 red cards. That's a new record. since records began, you know, basically since Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, and when Opta was there, obviously, already, nobody has ever done that. This weekend, there was also a new record set, which is the fastest red card in French football history. 9 seconds.
Ah, good.
It's pretty good.
That is good.
The new holder is Jean-Claire Todibo of Nice, who was running back to stop an Angers attacker and just outside the penalty box. And he stopped him, and he was deemed to be the last man. And he was sent off. There you go. So yes, it's quite extraordinary. It's probably due, yes, to some instructions given to referees. But there's an awful lot of discussion about this in France. At the moment, the discussion around Football is France is quite mad, as you might have seen, Max, between that and the French Federation, the sexual abuse allegations, the Pogba affair, Mbappé not wanting to be part of a photo shoot with the French national team, then joining it. It's absolutely extraordinary. But this refereeing thing, French referees were always stricter. That's true. In terms, particularly in terms of violent conduct, they tended to show the red card perhaps more readily than some of their European, most of their European counterparts. But this season has gone completely crazy. Yeah, it's that 34 red cards in 8 rounds of Ligue 1 is it's just a little bit much, really.
I kind of meant like what's to speak in Parlay Sport? That phoning will be absolutely wild, won't it? On with Adrien Durham.
Maxime Rougedin.
Yeah, exactly. PSG, well, all those things you said that making French football mad, we'll try and cover all of them quickly. PSG are top. Messi scored the only goal over Lyon. Oh, lovely
beauty.
Move between him
beauty.
And Neymar, wasn't it? And
absolutely
like,
glorious.
And I said it in the intro, is he getting better? He obviously isn't getting better, but he's improving like other parts of his games. His assist stats are ridiculous in the last couple of years.
He's playing for a manager who is ideally suited to the job, who's got exactly the right personality for the type of players he has. You remember, Max, I said at the beginning of the season when they chose Galtier, I said they're in danger of becoming a really, really good side now. Mm-hmm. He's perfectly suited to the job. You can also see that the old magic between Messi and Neymar is back on, very much so. He seems to be physically fit as well, which was not the case last season. Which changes a lot of things. But the fact that he's had, I was going to say his best start to a season with the PSG jersey, it's not very difficult. It's only the second one. But it is a better start, certainly. And that Neymar is having, I think, one of his best, if not his best season for Paris, shows that there is a new balance, a new equilibrium, which has been found in that crazy club. The only thing which is really quite interesting is that, as you can imagine, everything that happens between the three of them is dissected. Just like the Spanish newspapers dissect who is sitting next to whom on a plane taking Real Madrid to a game. So, and now it's about who gives the ball to whom.
Neymar passes to Mbappe, but Mbappe doesn't pass to Neymar. Is that the wrong way around?
Absolutely. Mbappe passes to no one.
Right.
Mbappe didn't have his best game, it must be said, against Lyon. Maybe PSG didn't have best game against Lyon, who were really, really tough, and I thought quite impressive in the second half, by the way. But the fact that Messi passes to Mbappe, Mbappe doesn't pass to Messi, Messi passes to Neymar, Neymar passes to Messi, it's basically a triangle where one of the bases of the triangle is not communicating with the others as they should.
Imagine not passing to Messi.
Yeah.
How can you not pass the ball to Lionel Messi? Like, that is some confidence.
We need a new Pythagoras for a new theory about this particular triangle. The Mbappe, and it's not the Bermuda triangle, it's the Mbappe triangle.
Yeah.
What happens? We don't know.
What else is happening? Fun game between Marseille and Rennes. Matteo Guendouzi scoring both. Own goal in the first half, header in the second. One for the frizzy head 11.
Yeah, and Marseille did some slight, you know, slowing down a little bit, but still a fantastic start to the season. Only 3 points behind PSG, so not going too badly.
Pigeons stopped play in this match. A flock of pigeons landed on the pitch 5 minutes before the final whistle. How do I say pigeons stopped play? Le pigeon arrête le...
You're doing very well.
Le jeu. There we are. Okay.
My gosh.
What do you want to talk about? Lorient.
Yeah, I wanted just a quick word because probably I won't get a chance to have another quick word about Lorient next time.
It's very unlikely, isn't it?
It's a bit unlikely. It's the highest position they've ever been in the league. They're third. They're a team normally that would be, in a good season, they would be mid-table and struggling. But Les Merlus, to give them their nickname, which is the Hakes, are doing extremely well indeed. Fourth victory on the trot, that was at Auxerre. Now, Auxerre is not doing too well at the moment, but what they're doing is quite remarkable. They've got a manager, Le Bris, who's never managed a top flight game before. He was in charge of the reserves before that. He gets in now. He's got, I think, one of the most exciting young talents we're seeing in Ligue 1 at the moment. I know there are plenty. He's only 20 years old, comes from Burkina Faso, Dango Ouattara. He has scored again. It's his fourth goal, also five assists since the beginning of the season. I'm not sure he's going to stay at Lorient for too long, but let's enjoy it where it lasts. So Lorient having their day in the sun, and I'm very happy to be able to say that on the pod.
Part of me just wishes in some way that Lorient were the feeder club for Leighton Orient or vice versa. You know, that, you know, Matty Lockwood and Joby Mackinoff would just, you know, they'd earn their spurs at Orient and then go to Lorient. Okay, let's cover off all those things you were saying, Philippe, starting with the most depressing. Romain Molina, your mate, and writing for your friends at Josimar, has revealed 40 years worth of alleged sexual abuse cover-ups, not only at the French FA, the FFF, but also within the LFP, which is what specific? What's the LFP?
Ligue de Football Professionnel. Yeah.
Okay. According to the report, several cases of sexual abuse, blackmail and harassment towards underage players, boys and girls that involve coaches, scouts and agents, as well as senior officials working in the French top flight. Thierry Rey, the sports advisor to the former French president, François Hollande, said that word of the allegations never reached him. He said, the FFF never spoke to me to ask about it. Neither did they speak to the sports minister. The gravity of the facts should have been taken seriously. It feels from these reports a real echoes of, you know, those horrible stories that we've heard regarding Barry Bunnell and others in the UK.
But on the systemic and systematic place, and what is really most concerning, that I don't know what is most concerning. The fact that the sexual abuse is rife in football is unfortunately, you know, not a revelation. And I think we're only seeing a tiny, tiny, tiny number of the stories surfacing for obvious reasons. The victims don't want to, well, they don't want to expose themselves to what a victim of sexual abuse is exposed to in our society, which is doubt, accusations, and putting your whole life on the line. And the good news is that the current sports minister has actually asked for all the dossiers to be passed on to her. So I think that in this particular case, we might actually make some progress and some quite dramatic progress in not too long.
As you say, all of these cases rely on the you know, the evidence of survivors. And it is,
yes,
their bravery, and we've seen it in cases in England, their bravery is sort of beyond, it's so exceptional.
Yep.
And actually something that we haven't, it's very hard to discuss it on the pod, but we probably should do, or, you know, talk to those people who are involved, because those stories are, I mean, they are horrific, but they're something that we all need to face. The bravery to come out and do it years and years later, and the wounds that it reopens and the stigma that is attached to it, because actually what's interesting is then suddenly you're not regarded as whoever, ex-footballer, it changes how people view you.
And obviously there are so many awful people out there, mm-hmm, on social media in particular. As soon as you tell your story, mm-hmm, they fall on you and say, you're a liar, you're this, you're that, you deserved it. how dare you do that? This, which has happened to a French woman international who wrote a book last year, I believe, and has been since then the target of absolutely unbelievable abuse. It's just so depressing. It's beyond words, beyond words.
It's so depressing, yeah. Philippe, you wanted to talk about Mbappe and the French FA?
I think, yeah, because I think that's a really interesting one, especially in the wake, you know, of the conversations we had with Rory about his new book on expected goals on data. Now, it's really, really interesting that it's twofold. Kylian Mbappe, obviously, is the boss with the French team, all right? He's the boss. And he was asked to take part in a photo shoot by the French Federation and refused. And he said, because I want to control my image rights, it's not up to you to tell me who I should do photo shoots for. It's up to me. We have to discuss. And which is the first time it's ever happened, by the way, with the French football team. Within a matter of hours, the French FA explained that there had been a meeting and they had found a solution, and therefore the photo shoot would, you know, they had changed the so-called contract or convention between the players and the FA. So the photo shoot has or is taking place as we speak. But it's to do with the more general idea of, do players control their data? Do you remember when Zlatan, you know, got into trouble because he actually challenged the fact that, I can't remember which game that was using his likeness, and people laughed him out. Ah, no, of course not. You gave those away. Well, not for long. This is going to be one big revolution and one big income stream for very wealthy players already. Is that FIFPro has also, which is the association of professional footballers at the world level, has released yesterday a charter for the protection of data of players. So the next step is going to be how players will sell their own data.
If I say, well, Mbappe, you scored two goals, that's not his data, right? I know that.
No,
can't sue me for that. So it's just when it gets quite, it's when it gets sort of technical. I mean, do you use, Mark, how much do you use these stats?
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly, as Philippe was alluding to there, in terms of, you know, what you're able to say bet on now, maybe there would be some players that don't feel that, you know, tackles and shots you shouldn't be able to maybe offer markets around, say, something like that. And I mean, what even... We own the website Soccerbase, which is quite a sort of popular data collection and has been for a number of years. And one of the things on there is players' heights. And we've had players, because not all of them are correct, you know, they're as good as we could get them. But you get some players that their agents or the players themselves will get in touch and say, you need to change my height. I'm actually 6 foot one, not 5 foot 11 or something. And you're costing, they'll say, you're costing me a move. You know, people are looking at this and they're thinking I'm, and so, you know, this was a website that was created a long time ago. And, before these kind of, issues had opened up. Now, we don't believe that height is something that, is a bit like goals. It's something that's just there in the open, but it is a very much a Pandora's box. I suspect that the clubs will the clubs will tighten it up. I think that's probably where it needs to come from. That the clubs say, well, you know, you're going to work, and your work is part. You know, and this is a data stream, but it's open to debate at the moment for sure.
Neil says, any other business, it's mainly about players with frizzy hair. After we discussed Leicester's centre-back Bout Face, the latest frizzy-haired footballer in the Premier League. Can't believe Emerson, says Neil, didn't make the frizzy-haired 11. Look, we're just starting there. Surely he defined the look. Marcus says, how could you have a conversation about frizzy-haired defenders and not mention Carlos Puyol? His power was contained in his curls. You really need to consider him before jumping to such outrageous conclusions about long-haired players. So I've come up with a frizzy-haired 11. Higuita, and then a back four. Boutface has to go right back. Lalas, Puyol, Cucurella, with David Luiz holding. Guendouzi, Emerson and Marcelo, who's playing left wing, because that's basically what he did, with Fellaini behind Valderrama, which I think is quite a good frizzy head. And just how much fun would it be to see those guys running around the pitch, flopping everywhere? If I have forgotten anyone, do let me know. And finally, well done to Grimsby fan, comedian Lloyd Griffith, who sung the national anthem at Grimsby and then at Brentford against Arsenal. And he was pretty amazing. Whether you like the national anthem or you don't, it's a different conversation, but he's an excellent singer. Damn multi-talented people. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Philly.
Thank you, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.